So, question. How much have you talked about this in lab? You haven't done active? You should have. You've done active range of motion. You haven't done passive or resistive, but you've done active, right? No, just getting a sense of range of motion. Okay, so I'm going to introduce it to you now, because range of motion is something you got to consider range of motion when you're looking at stretching, for example, right? Because an indication for stretching would be limitation in range of motion, right? So it needs to be discussed about. So when we examine specific joints, there should be an unchanging systematic approach to the examination that varies only slightly to elaborate certain clues given by the history or by asymmetric responses. So what does that mean? What does that mean? It means that if Vera is looking after Mrs. Jones and Vera takes a holiday, okay, and then Ray comes in to do her work for her because she's on for a couple of weeks and Ray sees Mrs. Jones, then the way that Vera tests the patient's range of motion is exactly the same way that Ray's measuring of the range of motion is exactly the same. You have to have that standardization so that everybody knows and should rightly understand that whatever you come up with the range of motion, you know, degrees or whatever it may be, that they can be seen by another practitioner the same way. So range of motion evaluation should be done exactly the same by a physician, orthopedic surgeon, physiotherapist, chiropractor, massage therapist, kinesiologist. It doesn't make any difference. So that's how systematic it has to be. It really has to be done a particular way. And then it varies only slightly to elaborate certain clues given by the history. That's simple. Someone comes in complaining of low back pain, that will be that range of motion. Someone comes in and complains of knee pain, it will be the range of motion of the knee. Someone comes in and has pain in the shoulder, it will be the range of motion for the shoulder. So that's your variation. But the systemic way in which you, sorry, the systematic way in which you move the limb through the motions should be done the same by all. And then, of course, by asymmetric responses. So the other thing you're going to learn in assessments is that when a patient comes into the room, you are assessing that patient the moment they walk through the door. How are they walking? How are they moving? Maybe even in the change room, you saw them come in and they took their coat off to hang on the hook because they've come in from outside. How did they take their coat off? Did they do it appropriately or did they struggle with it and do it some kind of funky way to avoid one arm versus another doing the full range of motion? So those are the things you have to start thinking about. As the movements are tested, the therapist is looking sometimes for the client's subjective responses and sometimes for clinical objective findings. What is the difference between subjective and objective? Okay. A better way of factual would be from the sense of range of motion, measurable, right? So this would be you would, because you guys all, you probably haven't pulled your goniometers out yet, have you? So you have a thing that looks like a protractor in your kit, right? Okay, where you're actually a little bit next semester, but for sure semester three, you will actually be measuring degrees of movement, assessing your patients or yourselves in lab before you get to patients. And that's objective information, right? It's measurable, it's consistent. Subjective is something that in some cases has an emotion behind it, but it's a statement that's not measurable. You know, one of the things that's very difficult to measure subjectively or objectively is pain. So how many people here, like something that I always talk to students about in later semesters, because you have to come up with your treatment plan and your goals, right? You have to have your treatment goals. So you meet with Mrs. Jones and you have a conversation with her and you find out she's got pain in her shoulder and you know you feel at the end of your assessment that she's probably got supraspinatus tendonitis, and then a student will put in, one of my goals is I want to get rid of her pain. That's never a goal. Why? Because pain is subjective. You might fix Mrs. Jones' shoulder so it is functioning from an objective point of view completely normally. But when you ask Mrs. Jones how it feels, she's like, oh, still hurts like crazy. So pain is not something you ever attempt to achieve objectively because it is of such subjective nature. You know, you'll get some individuals with a hangnail on their finger, and they'll give you a score of 10 out of 10, and other patients will give you a score of 0 or 1 out of 10. You just never know because there's so much influence of other things that influence people's subjective perception of pain. It's a very difficult thing to kind of nail down objectively. Now, there are tools out there, so you may have seen this before in an emerge department. So pediatric physicians will use a smiley face to a sad face for a child because children really struggle with pain. They can't perceive pain the same as adults. It's hard to believe, but they really can't. Children can have something really terrible happening to them, and they won't react like an adult to the amount of pain they're having. Or you would perceive, looking at the injury, the amount of pain that they would have. So you have this little continuum of, at this end, like a big, huge smiley face, and at this end, a really sad, downturned face. And then the individual picks where they are on all the different faces. And it's called the McGill Pain Scale, and it's a way of trying to objectify something that's subjective. And you're going to find a whole bunch of those, but I'm not getting into those. But those are coming. You can reduce pain level, increase function, those sorts of things. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. You know, that would be your goal to do that, right? But being aware that because, like, for example, from an insurance point of view, like if you're seeing a motor vehicle accident patient, they want nothing to do with subjective information. They want cold, hard facts. And if you can show that, you know, 15 degrees of flexion started, became 90 degrees of flexion of the shoulder, that's what they're looking for. Is it right? Not necessarily in some cases, but that's just the kind of the nature of how they work. So why do we need range of motion? Well, we need range of motion to perform ADLs. And what are ADLs? Activities of daily living. Give me some examples. Brush. What else? Putting your coat on. Yeah, tying your shoes, walking steps, mowing the lawn, washing dishes, right? Doing laundry, vacuuming, all the things you would consider, well, you wouldn't consider because they're so fundamentally natural for us to do. It's not until something goes bad, like a sore back or a sprained ankle or something, that those ADLs, you kind of realize what you took for granted. And so you need normal range of motion in order to do things. My prime example always is, I always use, because one individual I had, a lady putting on a bra, right? Imagine what you need to do to put on or take off a bra for that back strap. Now, you can spin it around to the front and do the turny-turny, right? You can do the spin around, but just picture, if you want to do the strap in the back, what does that shoulder need to do, right? It needs to extend, internally rotate, okay, and adduct, okay? And so if Mrs. Jones says, I can't do that anymore, your knowledge of that the joint does flex, extend, adduct, internally, externally rotate, you break it down and go, well, she can't do that, then what's missing in her function that's preventing her from doing something like that, right? I think I told you guys, when I had the first, you know, I've had both shoulders done, and one of the first goals for myself was wash my hair, because that's as high as I could get my hand when the sling finally came off. What's that? Yeah, exactly. I remember just like, oh, I just want to be able to wash my hair with two hands, right? To meet functional requirements. So we need range of motion to do all these things. So what is the evaluation? What is it? What are we evaluating? So initiation. Can the client initiate the movement that you're asking them to do? Upon your observation, is the range that the joint's moving through, is it normal? Now, how do we know if it's normal? The unaffected side, right? Or what? You go to your McGee book, and in there are your normal degrees of range of motion in there. So if Mrs. Jones happens to have bilateral rheumatoid arthritis of both shoulders, and she's limited to both, then you kind of have to go to the textbook and say, what's normal flexion for the shoulder? Now, Mrs. Jones, if she has a disease state like rheumatoid arthritis, ain't getting to full range, right? But at least you have a sense of where the normal is and where she is in the range of normal, okay? Identifying abnormal range of motion, identifying pathological range of motion. Now, you're going to learn something called end feels. And you have to think about what's happening and what is it that's diminishing the patient's range of motion. For example, is there neurological dysfunction? So is the muscle that initiates the movement in the range, has it been compromised due to something like a disc herniation or peripheral nerve palsy or neuropathy or something like that, right? Is the joint that's moving in the range, is there something bony-wise wrong with the joint? Are the two bones, is there been a change in shape in the joint, which would affect the ability of the bone to move through, and so on and so forth? You're going to learn all these things. I'm just trying to plant a few seeds to get you to understand a little bit of what you're looking at when you just ask Mrs. Jones just to do that, okay? So when I pathological range of motion, I said could be the structure of the joint, so how the two bones relate to each other, the integrity of the joint. So remember, we have holding elements to joints, which are, of course, ligaments and muscles. So you have ligamentous laxity or a rupture of a ligament or something. The integrity of the joint starts to diminish, which will affect range. The flexibility of the tissues. So scar tissue and soft tissue, those sorts of things can, you know, limit how much stretch soft tissue can do, which is going to limit range of motion. So if I have a significant scar in my triceps that's very limiting to my range of triceps, that's also going to affect my flexion to my shoulder because the tissue won't be able to stretch enough to go into full range. What systems are involved in range of motion? The nervous system, of course, because it's speaking to muscles, whether it's inhibiting them or whether it's initiating movement from the muscle itself. The muscular system itself, are the muscles good? Are they functioning properly? Cardiovascular system, joint surfaces, as I've already expressed, the joint capsule. So if the fibrous capsule is tight and a problem with the capsule, that will diminish range of motion. Ligaments, which I suggested, fascia itself can really have an effect on range of motion. What can limit our range or increase? So normal or abnormal muscle length. So you'll think of the gymnast as the abnormal length and able to go into crazy ranges of motion that are beyond normal. Whereas, you know, if they're tight, it won't. The joint capsule again, the ligaments, joint surfaces, joint shape. Now, when I give you these, what I want you to start to do is when you're watching your peer in the lab move through a range, these are what you're considering for yourself when they're, say, limited. Which of the following could be the cause of why the person can't go through range? Yeah. Yep. Yes, correct. So no, you can't if you've got something. So from that perspective, then you can't. So the forearm can't get to the shoulder if the bicep is so large that just physically, architecturally, it's just in the way they can't get there. That you can't necessarily fix. But if you they can lose a bit of range of motion, say an extension, if in fact the muscle's tight, that can be fixed. But short of taking a scalpel and taking a chunk out of bicep, that unfortunately is not going to change so much, right? Yeah, yes, right. It's the same as, the big guys, right? They walk like this because their lats are so big. They haven't been able to touch their hips for many years because they walk around like this, right? They just can't get around their body size. It's just too large. Types of range of motion. So active free. Does this sound familiar? Have you done this? Active free this semester? No? Okay. So what's active, first off? So when we talk about passive range of motion, because I've used these terms a few times and maybe you didn't know what I was talking about. So there's active range of motion and passive range of motion. So you know some of the pictures I show you in the diagrams for stretching? Sometimes it shows the therapist moving the patient, and sometimes it shows the patient doing the movement. When the patient does the movement, that is considered to be active. And when the therapist moves, that's passive. So when we talk about range of motion, if it's active free, it's the patient initiating their own musculature to move the joint on their own. So it is movement that is produced by the patient's muscle contraction. It is the movement that is performed by the client when we test active range of motion. So we just stand back and we watch the patient, and we ask them to move a limb, whatever that limb is, in a particular movement direction. In the case of shoulder, of course, you've got flexion, extension, AB, AD, external, internal, right? And so we're asking our patient to do all of those movements if that's the identified joint that is suggested to be the problem by the therapist. If the client cannot move so that's active free. They're doing it. Active assisted is not something we normally do for testing. Active assisted means that you've asked the client to move a limb in a range and they can't. So they're nothing's happening. Maybe they've just had a stroke, significant surgery or something. You ask them to do it, they can't do it. But you come over and you provide a bit of support. So you use your hand and you provide some support in the movement, and they are able to initiate some movement with your assistance. Okay? This is active assisted. So if the client cannot move a limb without assisting themselves, this is a sign of weakness or pain. Further investigation is necessary. Okay? Here's another line, one of Brian's famous lines, like structure versus governs function. Pain inhibits function. If something hurts, the patient will not move their limb in the direction of pain. They just won't do it, right? They may attempt to die, but if the pain gets too bad, they'll just stop and they won't move through it. So I would like to teach you guys something, but I know it's for next semester and I know it doesn't get done well, but it's kind of a great thing of mine. And it's about how you determine. If we find time today, I might do it. But we'll see. But just understand that if they can't move it and they need assistance, that's active assisted. Now, active resisted is what? What do you know it as? Yeah, which is known as, for the semester, what have you been doing? Muscle testing. It's muscle testing, right? Now you've done a little bit in this semester in terms of, you know, using the textbook and setting the patient up and having them move a particular way, right? The thing you need to understand with muscle testing, right, you are, in fact, actually challenging the muscle to contract and get a sense of how well it can create tension to overcome the resistance that you're providing, right? And then you have a score of 0 to 5. And so whether or not the muscle has no ability to overcome your resistance or lots of ability to overcome your resistance and everything in between, correct? Right? So that's what this is. It's basically muscle testing. So it's used for testing the strength of contractile tissues. It can also test nervous innervation, hence the reason why we do it. Hold a 5, up for 5, down for 5, right? That's the reason why we're testing the nervous system there. To assess for lesions of muscle and tendon, if the client is asked to resist isometrically with the segment in the neutral position, the force that will be placed is placed by the therapist. So for all purposes, we place the limb in somewhat of a neutral perspective, lining it up so that we identify or isolate the muscle we wish to test. We then apply a pressure on the muscle, forcing the muscle to contract against your pressure, and then we measure its ability to create contraction or tension enough to overcome your force, right? Since these tests give information on the strength of contractile tissues, they can be used to help determine both neurological dysfunction and musculoskeletal pathologies. So two reasons why someone can't create a 5 could be that neural innervation is poor for lots of various reasons, or again, pain inhibits function, it hurts too much, or the muscle's not functioning properly, architecturally, scar tissue, damage, injury, and so forth, and they're not able to produce enough tension. Okay? Passive. This is the movement of a segment within the unrestricted range of motion that is entirely produced by an external force, U. So we have them perform actively, and then we do exactly the same movement passively. I'll explain in a moment why that's important. Differences in active and passive range of motion may be caused by muscle contraction or spasm, muscle deficiency, neurological deficit, contractures, or pain. So, differences in active and passive can be caused by muscle contraction or muscle spasm, muscle deficiency, neurological deficits, or contractures, or pain. when we do active and passive range of motion, we are trying to determine if the condition the patients come in with is contractile or non-contractile. Kind of put that in your pocket and remember. When we're doing active and passive range of motion, we're trying to determine if the cause of pain is contractile or non-contractile. Okay? So contractile, of course, is muscle tissue. Non-contractile is ligaments, fascia, bony structures, those sorts of things, right? So when you compare active and passive, you are then able to determine whether or not the muscle is part of the problem or other structures are the problem. And then from there, you can further your investigation to figure out if it's non-contractile, is it fascia ligament, is it bone, so forth, right? Or nervous tissue and so on. Did I just kind of go way beyond you guys there? Okay, Krishan, come on up. So, we're just going to do something real simple. Okay? So, he's coming to me today complaining of arm pain. Okay? So, I ask him to do a bicep curl. So, what am I challenging there? Or brachialis or whatever it may be, right? Let's just say it's biceps for now. So, he does this and I say, does that cause any pain? He says a little bit. Okay? Just a little bit. So then what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask him to resist. I'm going to push down. I'm going to make that muscle work and go ahead. You're going to resist me. I'm going to push. And he goes, ah, it really hurts. Right? Okay? Then we're going to take one more step. Then I'm going to lengthen that muscle. So I'm assuming it might be biceps. So I'm going to bring it back here. And I'm going to straighten the elbow out, and he goes, ah, that hurts. Now, so you got that so far? Pain when he initiates, pain when he resisted, pain on stretch. So now I am going to passively move his arm into flexion, okay? So he's not going to do anything. And I go, does that hurt? And he goes, nope, not at all. What just happened? It's contractile. Why? Right. When he's doing it, or I'm lengthening it, it hurts. When I do the movement, which doesn't initiate his muscle, and it doesn't hurt, that's telling me it's a contractile issue. Does everybody understand that? Fantastic if you do, because that's something to take away. That's really important to understand, right? So pain on contraction and pain on stretch pretty much always means contractile structure. Okay? Now, if he said, I have pain in my shoulder area, he did this, no pain. I did this, no pain. But I did this, and he had pain. Or if I do this, and he had pain, it's non-contractile. Something's likely going on in here that's the problem, which is ligaments, bone, joint capsule, anything that's not contractile. Please remember that. It's so vitally important. Okay? Thank you. It's so important. It's a real foundational understanding that's required to start to get a sense of something that might be going wrong. So you're trying to determine the difference between contractile structures and non-contractile structures when you are sort of assessing people's problem. Okay? All right. So what should you observe then when you're doing this passively, as we just did, where in the range was the onset of pain or restriction, how the point of onset of pain or restriction compares to active, which we just did there, right? I did it passively and we didn't have the pain, but we had the pain or contraction, or we didn't have the pain or contraction and we had the pain on the passive movement. That tells us a whole lot, right? How the affected side's range compares to the unaffected side. So when we're looking at it, then obviously we're comparing flexion extension or ABA deduction or internal external rotation or lateral flexion or pronation supination. Like there's, you know, we're always comparing one or the other because we have to always double the both. If your patient has pain on flexion, then you should be testing flexion and extension. If it's on supination, you need to always test supination and pronation. Yes? Yeah, no, it's where it is. So, okay, so in his biceps wasn't a problem because biceps doesn't, I didn't have his bicep affect his shoulder joint yet, right? I was just testing the muscle. Now, I could have included the shoulder, but it was the key there was when I passively moved him with no contraction whatsoever, that caused the pain. So, again, flexion, extension, all those joints, ABA, deduction, of course, shoulders, fingers, and hip. External, internal rotation, of course, is neck, C-spine, shoulder, hip. Lateral flexion, neck, C-spine, trunk, L-spine, right? Pronation, supination, of course, the wrist. And then we've got protraction, retraction, plantar and dorsiflexion, inversion, eversion, depression, elevation, deviation, and opposition. So, this is why... You go, Brian, what do we need to know all this stuff, right? Because this is where it's all going to become action rather than just theory, because you're going to take all this stuff and apply it to your patient. And if you know what happens normally or what structures are responsible for what movements, then that starts to paint a picture for you when the patient comes in and says, ow, I hurt. Okay? All right. Just give me a second here. Yeah, that's what's coming. Oh, fun stuff. I love that stuff. Don't worry, I'll get you through it. Okay, so stretching part one. Where are we here? Yeah, someday I should probably learn to file properly. That's kind of strange for to go. There you go. Sorry, guys, I can't find the... It's kind of strange. DQR. Weird. I'm missing something here. I don't know why I'm missing it. The two slides that you've got there that I gave you in Blackboard, I can't seem to find them. Yeah, no, they're in Blackboard. I just can't seem to find them in my PowerPoint slide sets, which is very strange. Oh, it might be here. Hang on. There it is. Sorry. There it is. Where it is. Okay, so with that in mind, of course, one of the things we're going to do to increase range of motion is that. Okay, so what is stretching? What is stretching, folks? What is it? Okay. And by the way, the picture on there, I put it on there on purpose because that's a terrible stretch. Really hard on the knee. So, the dictionary definition of stretching is a general term used to describe any therapeutic maneuver designed to increase the extensibility of soft tissues by elongating, lengthening structures that have adaptively shortened and have become hypomobile over time. Make sense? Right? Okay. So, what is mobility? It is the ability of structures or segments to move or be moved to allow the presence of range of motion for functional activities. So, when I'm going to talk about this a little in a couple of weeks, we need to get to a point where, just so you know, in the past, I have, in some cases, gone in the backyard of my house with a pair of baseball gloves and a ball and had the patient throw a ball at me. I throw a ball at them. I've also had a hockey stick and a puck and watched them shoot a hockey stick or watched them go for a run or walk. Why am I doing that? No, not right. Okay, what else? What does form mean? Not just posture. Yeah. Sometimes compensation, you know. Yeah. What do you mean by poor posture? Right. Okay, so mechanics.
Yeah.
Do you play cricket?
Yeah.
Do you bowl?
Yeah.
Come here. So, cricket and bowling. What's bowling and cricket? They don't know. Think of baseball and pitching. It's a bit different, but the same idea. Okay, so the bowler is going to throw over their head, right, on a run, and the arm comes over the head, and then, you may not know this, everybody thinks cricket's easy, the spin he puts on the ball, he doesn't throw the ball to a catcher. He throws the ball to hit the dirt deliberately, and whatever spin he puts on it, it kicks right, it kicks left, it kicks low, it kicks high. Yeah, and then you have to hit it off the ground. Not as easy as it looks, especially if you've got a bowler that can bowl a ball about 110 miles an hour, which the big teams, the bowlers can easily do that. So, what we need to do when we talk about segments, we have to understand what it takes to bowl, okay? So what I would do if he came to me and his shoulder was bothering him or whatever, I would ask him to walk through bowling. So you're going to pretend that you're going to bowl. I don't want you to run. I just want you to walk and go through all the motions. So how many steps you would take, okay, and then over the top. So segmentally, what am I looking at here? And his legs and his shoulder, right? So you have to understand that what's happening here, this is called a lever, okay? And he is moving his limb at a particular speed through. It's the same as pitching a baseball in baseball. So the pitch comes from back here, there's a turn of the hip, then the thorax, then the shoulder comes over the top, and it continues shoulder, elbow, wrist. Same with him. Except because he comes over the top, his wrist, his elbow tends to be extended back here, whereas in baseball, the elbow tends to get extended here. But he's still finishing with his wrist. This is something, again, I'm just giving you this so you can remember it. When I talk about segmentally, I need to break this down. And I have to look what's functioning and what isn't functioning within that movement. Okay? Thank you. You can take a seat. So, there's a right way to do it and there's a wrong way to do it. But you need to be able to segmentally break it down. So, the ability of structures or segments to move or be moved to allow the presence of range of motion for functional activities. For Kishan to bowl, he needs full range of shoulder, elbow, and wrist to finish. Right? Now, I don't do it right, I know that. But, and interesting, they always line up this way. Right? It's always from here, and then it comes over the top. Do you play indoor here? You know, do we have indoor here? Yes. We have a team, too. Indoor cricket, yeah. And the gym. And we play other colleges. We actually usually have a tournament here every year. You should look into it. Yeah. I've tried it in the gym. It's hard. Anyway, but that's the point when I talk about segmental. Now that was an example of bowling, but what movements do you need to be a bit intimate? What do you need to wipe your bum? What do you need to comb your hair? What kind of movement do you need to do to mow the lawn? You know, hammer a nail in a board, right? All of them have those same kind of segmental things. Usually what makes people kind of come to look for help is pain within those segmental movements of functional activities, whatever they may be, right? That's what generally tends to bring them out because they're like, I can't seem to do this anymore, whatever that is, okay? It is also the ability of an individual to initiate, control, or sustain active movements of the body to perform simple to complex motor skills. This is known as functional mobility. So again, depending on what they're wanting to do. And this is where treatment goals come in. So again, a little planting a seed here. Patient comes in, they got a pain problem, something's going on. Well, what do you want to do, Mrs. Jones? Right, well, I want to get back in my garden in the spring, get down on the ground and plant my petunias and roses and everything else. I can't seem to do that anymore. I get too much pain with it. That becomes your ADL functional goal. Okay, that's where we need to get you. Once you have your big goal, then you start walking back. Where are the small steps to get to the major goal? Because you have to say to yourself, well, I know right now Mrs. Jones can't, she might be able to get down to the ground, but she ain't getting back up because maybe she's not strong enough, right? Maybe she needs more core strength or whatever it may be. So then you start building accordingly. But first, you got to figure out where the segment and the range problems are before you can determine what the exercise prescription would be to get her so she can get in the garden and plant her flowers. Everybody following me? Okay? And really, really keep this in mind because it's going to come back over and over and over again. You are expected in the clinical setting to create home care for your patient, which means sending them home to do things to make themselves better. Now, of course, the requirement in semester 3 is a lot less than the requirement in semester 5 and 6, but I want to get those creative juices flowing a little bit so that you start thinking about that when you see clients eventually in the clinical setting. Functional range of motion, of course, is associated with joint integrity as well as the flexibility. So what does the inside of the joint actually look like in the relationship of the bones in the joint? And of course, you know, we said for muscles to affect the joint, it has to cross the joint. Well, within that muscle, we have fascia. We also have soft tissue, joint capsules, and so forth. How are they affecting range, and are they the problem we need to consider? This allows for unrestricted, pain-free movements during the functional tasks of daily living. Okay? Is it normal to lose functional tasks of daily living? Not at all. Unless you got disease states, 95, yeah. So, you should still be able to do functional movements. You should be able to perform functionally. So the big study that was done, this is a bit of a thing that I got into years ago before I became a massage therapist, it was geriatric work. They did a study a number of years ago in Europe, and they took a shopping bag that was 20 pounds. And the study was that they took elderly individuals, both male and female, and they put them on an intersection with a walking light. When the light turned walk, they had to pick up the bag and walk across the street to the other side before the light changed to stop. The majority of them couldn't do it. You know the number one reason why they couldn't do it? Deconditioning. They weren't strong enough to lift the bag, and they weren't in cardiovascular good enough health to actually walk across the street with a bag. That was the number one reason. It wasn't arthritis. It wasn't disease states. It was deconditioning. And I always tell everybody this at this point. When grandma's at the house for Christmas or Thanksgiving and someone says, I'll do it for your grandma, say no. Kick grandma in the butt and get her off the chair and make her go do it herself. Because that's the number one reason why. It's also the number one reason why people go into long-term care. Not disease states. It's deconditioning. Grandma can't reach up in the cupboard and get her coffee anymore. She can't put the garbage away because she's deconditioned. She can't do it. So I took it to heart because I went and saw a gerontologist years ago. In a thing, because I used to work for WSIB. So I did a study, a real quick study. Didn't even know it was a study at the time. I took 3 individuals in long-term care where I was working. 2 of them were in wheelchairs, and 1 of them was in a walker. And all I did is once a week, I took cans of beans and surgical tubing, and I just had them do really simple strength training stuff. 6 weeks, the 2 that were in wheelchairs, one was using a walker, and the other one was using a cane, and the one that was using the walker was walking normally without a walker. And all I did was strengthen them. So no matter if you're 22 or 95, your muscle can adapt and gain strength. Correct. Correct. Well, he showed us that. So this was at London. It was a gerontologist specialist in London. They showed us MRI results where individuals looked like they hadn't lost muscle mass. When they did the MRI, it was all fat infiltration. So you had so much muscular atrophy, it was replaced by fat infiltration. And all you had to do was just challenge those muscle fibers again. No, they weren't going to get back to, you know, being whatever, but they'll train. Those muscles, small muscle fibers will train and get better, and they're able to better function. Maybe not like a 20-year-old necessarily, but at the very least, they're able to have less falls, right? You know, which is a problem with the elderly and that kind of stuff. It's all about training them. So make grandma get off her ass and go get her own drink in the kitchen. Yeah, come on, grandma, let's go. Range of motion needed for the performance of functional activities does not necessarily mean full or normal range of motion. So, shoulder surgeries, for example. Let's use knee replacement. What do you think the normal range is for post-knee replacement, or the range they want you to achieve after knee replacement? Any idea? 90 degrees. Do you know that after knee replacement, you will never touch your heel to your bum ever again? If you can get to 100 degrees of flexion, they're doing the Snoopy dance. Why? Because all you need is 90 degrees to do anything functionally. You can walk upstairs, you can ride a bike, you can walk. That's all you need. So you've got to get to 90 degrees, right? Same as shoulder. If it's bad enough, they're happy with this. Because you can do a lot of functional work here. Think of how often do you really reach above your head to do things. It's minimal at best. Yeah. But functionally, you can do pretty well with shoulder here and knee to 90 degrees. You know, what's interesting about knees, I don't know how many patients I've talked to who had a knee replacement who either the physician or the surgeon never told them they'd only get 90 degrees of flexion. They thought, like the hip, they would have the knee replacement and their knee range would be completely like it was before surgery or before the knee got to be a problem. Yeah, so hips, no problem. We can get hips back pretty good, but knees are 100 degrees tops. Yeah. Knee replacement is not as good as hip, unfortunately. So stretching interventions are an integral component of an individualized rehabilitation program when restricted mobility adversely affects function and increases the risk of an injury. So again, you know, you watch somebody do something in their day-to-day life. It doesn't have to be sports. It could be whatever they do around the house, and then you work from there. How do I get that range back to put a bra on, brush my hair, whatever it may be, okay? Terms. Flexibility. The term is to move a single or series of joints smoothly and easily through an unrestricted pain-free range. To do this, you need normal muscle length. You need good joint integrity. You need the periarticular soft tissues being able to lengthen and stretch. You need proper arthrokinematics. Do you remember those? I did do those at the beginning, right? I talked about spin and glide. Have you guys done that in lab? Okay, I'll do those later on. For now, just need to understand the interaction between the two bones in the joint. Need to function properly. And the ability of periarticular connective tissue to deform. Connective tissue doesn't stretch, it deforms. It lengthens, it changes, and comes back to normal again. But it doesn't stretch. Dynamic flexibility, also known as active mobility or active range of motion. This is the degree to which an active muscle contraction moves a body segment through the available range of a joint, such as what Kishan did with bowling, that shoulder range that's required functionally. Passive flexibility, of course, is the degree to which a body segment can be passively moved through the available range of motion and is dependent on the extensibility of the muscles, connective tissue, and periarticular structures in the tissues. Now, it could be that your patient's had shoulder surgery and you can't actively get them to do range of motion, you might be doing passive to begin with, to get normal range back to some degree before you actually ask them to start actively moving through, okay? I usually all do this. I'm kidding. What's that? That was Chuck Norris, right? Wasn't it Chuck Norris that did that, or was it? Was Jean-Claude, right. Jean-Claude Van Damme did that in a movie. He was able to do this. Yeah. I don't know how, but. Hypomobility, decreased mobility or restricted motion, and many things can influence movement and restrict mobility. Do you guys have the REMX book? Got it in my head. I can't think of the name of the author. It used to be Baby Blue in color. Don't worry about the pages. It'll come back again because I don't really use the book anymore. It's an older, bit of an older slide, but you do have the REMX book. I believe you've already got it. Contractures. Now, this is something you're going to come across that is completely different than tight muscles, okay? A contracture is the adaptive shortening of the muscle tendon unit and other soft tissues that cross or surround a joint. It results in resistance to passive or active stretch and limitation of range of motion. The designation of contractures is by location, the type that you have, and they are identified by the action of the shortened muscle. So in this case, this is known as a flexure contracture, a flexion contracture. You can see the fingers are flexed, right? The thumb is flexed and the wrist is flexed. This is all a neurological result of all the muscles that do these actions shortening and then seizing. You would never be able to move these fingers or this wrist. So it wouldn't happen. It's stuck. The one thing I want to tell you that people always forget about, this friggin' hurts. A lot of people don't, you know, you see it in long-term care post-stroke, you see these flexion contractures after stroke, and people just disregard them to some degree. They realize that they're a limitation because they can't use their hand, but no one ever considers that they friggin' hurt. Imagine you're stuck like this, and you know. And the other thing is, a lot of times in flexion contractures, the fingers come in, right, not at the metacarpophalangeal joints here, come in like this. And what ends up happening in here is anaerobic infections. And then the nails go in, and then you open the hand up and there's no flesh left here. Just rots away. Oh, there is. There's those little balloon things, like, have you ever seen that? Yes, it's about the size of your finger, and they have a little bladder on the end. They open the hand up like this. There's those splints that go on, right? Here's one for you. So you actually have a reflex. You can try this next time you're at work. Is your hand for a sec? So if he's in a flexion contracture, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the thumb. I'm going to pull the thumb out, right, just like that, not into a stretch, just like that. There's actually an inhibitory reflex when the thumb does this, and I can take the fingers and just pull them out like that and just hold them there, keeping that thumb out. Try it next time you're at work. Just pull the thumb back and... Yeah, so try that. Try the thumb pull back and the finger release. You might find it really works well for you. Okay, it's a neat little inhibitory brain arc that happens and relaxes the fingers. It's kind of cool. But this, yeah, there's nothing you can do with this unless you get at it early. You can make it less worse, if that's a word, if you can get it at it early. But if I went into long-term care and I walked into someone like this, yeah, not a whole lot I can do for that. I can rub it and apply some lotion and try to calm pain down, but I'm not getting any range of motion back in those fingers. That's pretty significant. Okay? And again, you'll tend to see this in long-term care more than anywhere. Again, because you have people with post-stroke sort of thing. And it is a neurological reaction. Do you know what one of the theories is? It's protection. If you think about all the vulnerable parts in your body, they're all covered up by flexion. Wrists, elbows, backs of knees, hip and belly. So one of the theories is that when there's neurological damage, the body goes into a protective posture to protect those flexion areas where there's sensitivity and vulnerability. Types of contractures. So the first is called myostatic, also myogenic. This involves the myotendinous unit has adaptively shortened and no specific muscle pathology is present. There may be a reduction in the number of sarcomere units in series, but no decrease in individual sarcomere length. This can be resolved by stretching, right? So what you're doing is you're going to lengthen the sarcomeres, and we haven't talked much about sarcomeres yet. Pseudomyostatic contracture is a hypertonicity, such as spasticity or rigidity, associated with a central nervous system lesion, such as a CVA, spinal cord injury, and so forth, and you get muscle spasm or guarding, and pain can also result in this. And in both cases, the muscles appear to be in a constant state of contraction, so they're in a constant resistance to passive stretch. Then there's arthrogenic and periarticular contractures. This has to do with stuff that's going on deep in the joint itself and the reaction around it. Adhesions, synovial proliferation, joint effusion, irregularities in articular cartilage, or osteophyte formation can result in these contractures. That basically, it's the result of the connective tissues that cross or attach to a joint, and they lose mobility, and they start to tighten up. So those things that normally stabilize the joint to some degree and cross the joint, they get tight, and the joint can't function properly. Fibrotic contractures and irreversible contractures. So these are fibrous changes of the connective tissue of the muscle itself, not the muscle cells, the connective tissue that sort of overlays the muscle, okay? And periarticular structures that cause adherence of said tissues that result in the development of a fibrotic contracture. Remember, fibrosis is scarring, right? Okay, form of scarring. One can stretch a fibrotic contracture, but it is very difficult to achieve optimal tissue length. Permanent loss of extensibility can occur when normal tissues are replaced with large amounts of fibrotic adhesions of scar tissue. This can happen after long periods of immobilization. So my shoulders, when I had my surgery, I was in slings for 8 weeks. Okay, so I had fibrotic adhesions in my shoulders that all had to be basically ripped apart to get my normal range back. I'm very fortunate. I have normal range of motion after surgery. Many individuals don't. Many only get to here, or not even that in some cases. So I had some great physio, kept at it, and I have normal range after having head shoulder repairs. The longer a fibrotic contracture exists, or the greater the replacement of normal tissues, the more difficult it is to reverse. I have that. If you can see my little finger, I can't flatten my little finger. This is known as de Putrin's contracture. Can you see the little pull-ins here? Right? You know what else it's called? Viking hand. There is a genetic. If you come from kind of Viking genealogy, which my family does, you get this. So eventually what will happen is this finger will slowly, and this one will pull in to the point where they're like that. Now, there are lots of treatments now for it, injections and those sorts of things to get, and they put chemicals in that break this fibrosis and scarring down so that the fingers can function properly. It's called a de Putrin's contracture. And it's idiopathic. It just happens. It's genetic. It was funny, my dad and my one brother and I were talking about it because I said, oh, I got this thing, and we all have it. We didn't even realize we all had it. Okay, that's stretching part one. You want a break? Okay, let's take a break for 10. I'll see you guys about 20 after, back around 20 after. There we are. Okay, stretching part two. So, this is about indications when to use that kind of stuff. One thing to understand, though, is something called selective stretching. So, the definition of selective stretching is improvement of function for the patient is a result of applying stretching techniques to some muscles and joints, but not allowing limitation of motion to develop, but allowing limitation of movement to develop in other muscles and joints. So this is a deliberateness of allowing some muscles to shorten, which actually improves function. So when determining which to stretch and which to shorten, one needs to consider the functional needs of the patient. It is a balance between mobility and stability. For example, allowing hypomobility to occur in the long flexors of the wrist with a C5 spinal cord injury, which allows for what is called a tendinosus grip. So a C5 under normal circumstances results in the hypertrophy of the thenar group muscles, and the hand ends up like this, okay? The idea is that because they can't use the thumb for grip, you deliberately allow the long flexors to contract and get hypomobile and tight, so you have this position. This is a functional position for the hand. So even though the hand is dysfunctional, this would allow the picking up of a wine glass, the grasping to some degree of structures. So it takes a bad situation and makes it a little bit better by providing a more functional position. Another area is someone who's had a high cervical spine injury and they're paralyzed or quad in a chair, we will deliberately take the core muscles, like the back, and have them all tighten and shorten to provide some stability in sitting upright in the chair. Okay, does that make sense? So look this up and just do tenodesis, and that will, there's a nice little gentleman has a little self, he's videoing himself and talks about how it's helped him in putting his hand in this particular position in his chair. It allows him to do much more functional things in his day-to-day life just by having that position stuck in his hand. Yeah. Yeah, they're purposely that way so they can function a bit better. Yep. Overstretching and hypermobility, of course, overstretching is overstretching beyond the normal length of muscle, range of motion of a joint. Of course, this would result in hypermobility. It makes sense. And when you, it's used in a sport that requires excessive flexibility. So MMA fighting, gymnastics, and ballet, there are many, many exercises that these individuals do within their sport or dance and so forth, where through coaching and techniques, joints are deliberately made to be hypermobile to perform the aesthetics of, right? Like how many people here right now, if I asked you, could do the splits to the sides? Can you? Can you do splits? So what they do is they'll take a young child and they'll get to a certain point, and then literally sometimes the coach is actually pushing down on the shoulders to get those muscles and ligaments at the hip joint to lengthen to get down into what the sport requires, which is an inappropriate really range of motion of abduction in the pelvis in order to be able to perform the splits which is required in the sport. Or bend backwards. You've ever noticed that some of these gymnasts in their spine can, it looks like they're actually folding, right? Because they have such flexibility. This can become detrimental with resulting instability. That's the problem with it. So when do we stretch? We stretch when range of motion is limited because soft tissues have lost their extensibility as a result of adhesions, contractures, and scar tissue formation, which ends up resulting in activity limitations, functional or participation restrictions, disabilities. Right, so when we think about disabilities, it could be a multitude of things that a patient can or is expected to do within culture, society, so on and so forth, day-to-day living. Restricted motion may lead to structural deformities that are otherwise preventable. Muscle weakness and shortening of opposing tissues have led to limited range of motion, and it can be the component of a total fitness or sport-specific conditioning program designed to prevent or reduce the risk of musculoskeletal injuries. So when we looked at Kishan throwing or bowling a cricket ball, then of course one thing I would do is look at his mechanics and try to increase range of motion or strength, and within the context of that then would lower his probability of injury if I can get his mechanics down better and get his whatever muscles are required to perform the task stronger and so on and so forth. And some of that is postgraduate work. So, if you wanted to go in that direction, you could take more courses to get better at that and get a better understanding of the mechanics. I'm just kind of introducing it to you. It can also be used prior to and after vigorous exercise to potentially reduce post-exercise soreness. Precautions. We never force a joint beyond what's considered normal range of motion. We use caution in patients with known or suspected osteoporosis due to disease, prolonged bed rest, age, or prolonged use of steroids. So, obviously, the potential for bone fractures is quite high if they have bad osteoporosis and we're asking them or we're trying to stretch them out. newly united fractures. So we've got some bone that was fractured and is trying to heal. Well, it's not a good idea to stretch that. Caution with aggressive stretching of muscles that have been immobilized for an extended period of time. We progress the dosage, so we slowly increase the intensity, we slowly increase the endurance, and we slowly increase how often they do it to minimize soft tissue injury. We do not stretch edematous tissue, so any kind of swelling, we don't stretch in that area, and avoid overstretching weak muscles, particularly those that support body structures. And of course, if someone is paralyzed and they have flaccid paralysis, we don't stretch that muscle either, right? Contraindications, a bony block, so that's where you have two bones that within their relationship to each other, the patient can only move so far and then the bone just stops the movement, so we don't stretch beyond that. There was a recent fracture and bone union is incomplete. Evidence of an acute inflammatory or infectious process or soft tissue healing that can be disrupted. So as a general rule, we don't stretch or exercise inflamed tissues. And frankly, we don't even massage inflamed tissues, right? We don't go in there and work on inflamed tissues. That's a contraindication as well. Sharp acute pain with joint movement or muscle elongation. If there's a present hematomas present or other indication of tissue trauma. If there's hypermobility that already exists, because you're going to come across that, right? Someone's going to have pain. You're going to expect hypomobility. And how many people here can take their thumb and put it on the forearm? Or, yeah, like that. Yeah, so that's a test for the likelihood that most of her joints are hypermobile. So quite often indications, she might come in with low back pain or something. You'd have her do range of motion. You go, oh, my God, she's no more range of motion, and then some. So obviously I wouldn't stretch her any further. That would be an indication maybe where strength is a requirement to get things stronger because of, you know, the discomfort that the patient may have. If we want shortened soft tissue to provide necessary joint stability, which I just showed, shortened soft tissues enable a patient, of course, with paralysis or severe muscle weakness to perform functional skills otherwise not possible, which we showed with tenonesis, right, with the hands. Benefits, of course, increase flexibility and range of motion. This helps us to regain, achieve, or maintain desired functional activities. Best types of techniques to increase flexibility and range of motion: static stretching or proprioceptive neuromuscular facilitation. Have you done PNF in lab yet? And do you understand it? Nope. Kind of. Okay. That's a more honest answer. Now, you didn't know what it stood for initially? Yeah. I'm going to explain how it works, trust me. Either today or next week. You'll understand it way better. Fundamentally, stretching or increase the flexibility and creates biochemical and neural changes in the contractile and non-contractile elements, which make it more functional. And then, of course, stretching and flexibility is an integral part of an exercise program, whether it be for general fitness, whether it be for recreational kind of sports, that kind of stuff, or whether it's for something you require at home or at work to, you know, better meet the need of whatever it is you need to do, again, at work or at play or at home, right? Injury prevention and reduce post-exercise muscle soreness. And I've got this in here because the book still says this, but any research I'm reading says that stretching does not prevent muscle soreness after working out. You know it as DOMS. Anybody here heard that term before, DOMS? Right? Stretching doesn't prevent DOMS. Neither does massage. And you're going to hear that massage prevents DOMS. It doesn't. Yeah, delayed onset muscle shortening. Yeah. More muscle soreness after exercise. You know when you work out for the first time in a while and you get up the next morning and go, oh, and you get those tender points in your pecs and your biceps, whatever. That is micro tearing and inflammatory reaction of the microscopic tearing of muscle tissue. So you can stretch to the couch, come home, and do massage. You're not going to repair the muscle tears. It's micro. What's that? No, that's my understanding is now I'm an idiot. So I like to take DOMS and work out harder. Like I like to stretch it out. I like that feel of pain. I think it feels really good. And I rub it and punch it. Right? Because when you work out for long periods of time, many years, you don't get that feeling anymore. And I like that feeling. It actually makes you feel like you did something. But yeah, stretching won't get rid of it. Our ability to perform our ADLs and other functions in our lives requires appropriate passive extensibility of soft tissues and the active ability of neuromuscular control. So to perform everything you do, whatever that may be, sports, at home, play, whatever it may be, you need normal neurological innervation for things to work, and you need all the soft tissues that cross those joints that get included in whatever those functions may be to be able to stretch out and get long enough so that the limbs can move all in normal ranges, okay? As we know, both contractile and non-contractile tissues can limit normal range of motion. Of course, if more range of motion is limited, so is mobility. More often than not, decreased extensibility of connective tissue, not contractile elements, is the cause of restricted range of motion. I'm going to repeat. More often than not, decreased extensibility of connective tissue, not contractile elements, is the cause of restricted range of motion. So it's not the muscles. It's the connective tissue that the majority of the time is the problem. Okay? Each of these tissues react differently when immobilized, and therefore each has their own reaction. So again, if you don't, like a sling where you're immobilized for a very long period of time, all that connective tissue gets shortened and problematic, and you got to lengthen it. You got to work with it and make it long again. Most information on the biomechanical, biochemical, and neurophysiological responses of soft tissues to immobilization and remobilization is from animal studies. So we're really not sure exactly how humans go, but we do know, and they have it in my physio clinic when I go occasionally, we have a big sign that says, motion is lotion. You move better. So if you ever look at, you know, we're talking a little bit about hip and knee replaces, those sorts of things, people don't stay in bed very long anymore, right? Whatever, no matter what procedure they're having, as soon as conceivably possible, we want them up, moving, walking around. Now we've limited, you know, we don't get the pneumonias like we used to get. We get better outcomes from orthopedic interventions and so forth. We want people to move. It's even if it's uncomfortable and it hurts, movement still is the way to go. It really is the way to go. And that's, so if you have decreased mobility, then the goal is to get that mobility back so that they can move and groove and get the body moving and get rid of the problems. Research is beginning to confirm previous experiments, as we know. What's happening when we stretch? We have elastic, viscoelastic, or plastic changes. What the hell does that mean? We're going to get to that in a minute. Both contractile and non-contractile tissues have elastic and plastic qualities. Only non-contractile connective tissues have viscoelastic properties. There is an endpoint for every smart sarcomere. Now, I haven't really introduced you guys to sarcomeres, have I? A little bit. So remember I said the muscle was striated? And you had these striations, right? Muscles, one long muscle fiber is one long cell. But within that muscle fiber are sections. So a muscle cell is made up of end-to-end sarcomeres, which are the functional part of a muscle, okay? We're going to learn a lot more about those coming up. But let's understand, sarcomere, 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 from one end of the muscle cell all the way to the other. Each of those sarcomeres either lengthen or shorten. Let's say you had 100,000 sarcomeres in one fiber in your quadriceps muscle. If every single sarcomere shortened, we'll just say 1 millimeter, and it had 1,000, how much of the muscle shortened? 1,000 millimeters, which is 1 meter. Okay? So understand that although they seem small, but they all add up. So each of them contributes a small amount to either get longer or either get shorter as far as that goes, right? Okay, so when we're stretching, there's only so far a sarcomere can shorten, and there's only so far a sarcomere can get long. So the reality is that when you're doing that static stretch on the table, whatever it is, you're not stretching muscle tissue. You're stretching all the connective tissue that surrounds all the muscle and all the muscle cells. So when you do that stretch, whatever that stretch is, you are in fact actually stretching connective tissue, not muscle cells. All the stretching techniques you learn are all about stretching connective tissue. Okay? So within that then, we have to talk about elasticity. Elasticity is the ability of soft tissue to return to its pre-stretched length directly after a short duration stretch has been removed. So elasticity says we can elongate it, and when we take that pull off, it goes right back to the length it was when it initially began. Okay? Viscoelasticity, also known as viscoelastic deformation, it is a time-dependent property of soft tissue that initially resists deformation when a stretch force is first applied. How many people here have done yoga? Okay, so you go into your stretch position, you're told to breathe, right? So you're breathing, and you stay in that position for long enough, and all of a sudden you can feel yourself go, you can feel, wow, right? And this is not to downplay yoga, because I like yoga, but a lot of you think it's the breath that makes the muscle elongate. It's actually the viscoelasticity of the connective tissue. So you put enough tension on that connective tissue, and all of a sudden you hold it long enough, the connective tissue deforms. Think of like having a piece of bubble gum. Pull on it, and it doesn't move, and then eventually you get that long string of bubble between the two pieces of bubble gum between the two pieces. Your connective tissue is doing exactly the same thing. It's actually deforming, right? If you deform connective tissue often enough and long enough, it doesn't return back to the shortened state. It starts taking on the lengthened deformed state. This is why stretching works. So by deforming the connective tissue viscoelastically of the muscle and the tendon, okay, you will, over time, deform the connective tissue and achieve a new length to the muscle, which results in an increase of range of motion of the joint that the muscle crosses. This is why we have to hold stretches, because you have to allow that deformation to take place. Okay? So, if the stretch is sustained, viscoelasticity allows a change in the length of the tissue and then enables the tissue to return gradually to its pre-stretched state after the force has been removed. You do it enough times, the pre-stretch state gets longer and longer and longer. But you have to stay on top of it, and you have to get to the point where you deform the connective tissue. That's what yoga is so good about. It takes you into those connective tissue blocks, and you stay with it through breathing. It keeps you through it, and then you get the deformation of the connective tissue, and you get the lengthening. Plasticity, also known as plastic deformation, it is the tendency of soft tissue to assume a new and greater length after the stretch force has been removed. Deformation or viscoelasticity in connective tissue results in plasticity. So this is what happens. You hold that viscoelastic connective tissue long enough, it makes a plastic change. In other words, it takes on a new length. And that's your goal when you're trying to stretch tissues, okay? So what exactly is a skeletal muscle? What are the names of the non-contractile connective tissues which hold the skeletal muscle together from deepest to outermost? I'm just going to say these quick because we haven't done these yet. We'll be doing them a little bit later. Or did we do endomysium, perimysium? We did all that, didn't we? Yeah. Okay. So endomysium surrounds the individual muscle fibers. Perimysium creates fiber bundles. Epimysium is the sheath that surrounds the entire muscle. Therefore, it is the connective tissue of the muscle that's the primary source of a muscle's resistance to passive elongation. In other words, when you're stretching a muscle, you are stretching the connective tissue of that muscle when you stretch that muscle to get deformation and then plastic changes. Any questions? Okay. Developed contractures occur as adhesions in and between the collagen fibers, and it is these adhesions between the collagen fibers that resist and restrict movement. So again, when we're vascoelastically stretching the connective tissue and getting the plastic changes, we are in fact actually also elongating the adhesions between the collagen fibers or breaking them apart, which allows for the new range of motion. All right? Any questions on that? Should I do this or not? Because I believe the next slide is... How many slides do we have here? Oh, let's do this. Sounds good to me. Okay. I alluded to this when I talked about the relationship of joints, of bones. So, accessory and physiological movements of joints. Accessory movements are those movements within the joint and surrounding tissue that allows for full range of motion but cannot be performed by activity. This is what is known as arthrokinematics. So when we look at two bones, in most cases, over here, when we look at two bones in a joint, under all cases, we have some kind of relationship. In a lot of cases, we have one bone that is concave in nature and one bone that is convex. And they have a relationship to each other in movement. We can't, through muscle elongation or neurological dysfunction, influence this relationship between these two. Okay? They just occur between themselves. And when that goes wrong, things go wrong. And that's what we're going to talk about. So, movements that are not under voluntary control but necessary to achieve full pain-free range of motion is known as joint play. So the relationship between the two bones in a joint, the way they react to each other, results in the kind of range of motion we get. One of the influences that results in the kind of range of motion we get. They cannot be created through active movement or contraction of muscle. So the first are component movements, and I think we've already done this in class earlier. These are involuntary obligatory joint motions occurring outside the joint. So the biggest example we went through was the scapulothoracic movement. Remember I said, you know, the scapula isn't a joint to the thoracic cage. It sits on the thoracic cage, but it doesn't have a joint with the thoracic cage. But if I limit the movement of the scapula on the thoracic cage, I significantly limit the range of motion of the shoulder, right? It's not a direct relationship because it's an accompanying active movement. So I need scapular rotation in order to achieve full ranges of motion in the shoulder joint. Anything that affects that component movement of the scapula, therefore then the shoulder joint will be limited in its range of motion. Right, and I think I did actually hold the scapula here, right? Did I do that in this class? Was it you? I actually held your scapula? Yeah, I just held it and asked you to abduct and you couldn't do it because the scapula has to move, okay? These are not necessarily mutually exclusive. In fact, the loss of one will affect the other. So again, I limit your scapula, your shoulder range of motion is going to go down. So that's the first thing that can happen is, you know, I would have to work on the musculature around that scapula to see what was limiting scapular movement in order to have the shoulder function properly. The next are called accessory movements. Oh, I didn't bring my ball with me. All right, so I'll draw them. So there's three movements here. There's spin, roll, and glide. So let's do spin first. Spin is rotation around a stationary axis, right? Can you think of something right off the top that you use every day that has spin? Do you all drive? Yeah, it's steering wheel, right? That's spin. Your stationary axis is the steering column, and you have the steering wheel that spins, right? So that is spin. Roll. We take a flat surface here, and we take a ball. New points on one articular surface meet new points on an opposing articular surface. So as the ball rolls, new points on the ball will touch new points on the table, correct? As it's rolling, right? That is roll. Now glide. The same point on one surface contacts different points on the other. So again, we'll use a ball and a table. So we'll say this surface here on the ball, as the ball slides forward, touches new points on the table. Yes? So we have spin, roll, and glide. Correct? Everybody follow me so far? Okay, pure glide never occurs because no two joint surfaces are completely congruent, but it still occurs. So we can see here. So, glide. This is the rule of convexity and concavity. So, if a moving surface is concave, glide occurs in the same direction as bone movement, And if a moving surface is convex, glide occurs in the opposite direction. This is the last thing we're going to do because we have to go because she gets mad because we're never done on time in this class. So I have a convexity, I have a concavity. Okay, so rule number one is, if the moving bone is concave, glide occurs in the same direction of movement. So let's pretend that this is a limb that's sticking out here, okay? And this is concave. So as the limb is moving down, is the glide going down? Yes, right? See that? Okay, everybody sees that? Okay. If the bone that is moving is convex, the glide will be in the opposite direction. So again, you've got an arm here. So as the arm goes up, can you see how the glide is going down? Right? If we didn't have glide, we would have spin. What would happen to the convex bone if it didn't glide and just spun? It would roll out of the joint, wouldn't it? Right? It would roll along that surface and leave. So how does it stay in? It glides and spins at the same time. So by the arm going up, right? So the arm, moment arm is going superior, so the glide is inferior. If the moment arm is going down, the glide is going up. So let's use a shoulder joint. You have a convex humeral head and a concave glenoid fossa, correct? In abduction, what movement is occurring? Superior glide or inferior glide? Inferior glide, because the bone that's moving is convex. So as my arm is going up, the glide is going down. An abduction is sliding superior. Okay, let's get complicated here. Right, now, flexion. Well, you see it from the side. It's an inferior glide. And then extension, superior glide. Last one, rotation, external and internal. So it's still a glide. So this is going posteriorly. So glide is anterior. And then this is going, an internal rotation is going anteriorly. So glide is going posteriorly. So what do we do with that? What's that? We're going to do it again next week. Trust me. Let's just say, just from a clinic perspective, if I had a condition in my shoulder joint where I lost inferior glide, what would I lose in range? Abduction and inflection. Okay? Anything that would limit superior glide, extension and adduction. Correct. Okay? So I can tell you that when my after my shoulder, had surgical intervention, and I was in a sling for a long period of time, the joint sticks. I have no glide. So even before the therapist started lengthening soft tissue, they did joint mobilizations first. They did techniques where they were increased the gliding that was occurring at the joint, and that started increasing my range of motion. It had nothing to do with soft tissue that crossed the joint. It was working with joint mobilizations. And we'll talk a little bit more about those next week. You're going to start learning joint mobs in semester, a bit of semester two and then semester three. Because anybody here, joint mobs done by a physio when they went for treatments where they grab a shoulder and they're doing this kind of stuff or no? It's really common. And you're going to, yeah, you've had that? Yeah. Well, we can do that. That's actually part of our scope of practice. Okay. So we'll talk a bit more about it next week. We'll just try to kind of wrap it around your head, right? The rules of convexity, concavity. If the bone that's moving is concave, the glide is in the same direction. If the bone that's moving is convex, the glide is in the opposite direction. So arm goes up, glide goes down. Arm goes down, glide goes up. Okay, see you next week. There'll be a quiz next week too, by the way.